The Consul's Tale. Remembering Ciri. I climbed the steep hill to Ciri's tomb on the day the islands returned to the shallow seas of the equatorial archipelago. The day is perfect, and I hate it for being so. The sky is as tranquil as tales of old Earth's seas. The shallows are dappled with ultramarine tints, and a warm breeze blows in from the sea to ripple the russet willow grass on the hillside near me. Better low clouds and gray gloom on such a day. Better mist or a shrouding fog which sets the masts in First Sight Harbor dripping and raises the lighthouse horn from its slumbers. Better one of the great sea simoons blowing up out of the cold belly of the south, lashing before it the motal isles and their dolphin herders, until they seek refuge in the lee of our atolls and stony peaks. Anything would be better than this warm spring day, when the sun moves through a vault of sky so blue that it makes me want to run, to jump in great loping arcs and to roll in the soft grass, as Ciri and I have done at just this spot. Just this spot. I pause to look around. The willow grass bends and ripples like the fur of some great beast as the salt-tinged breeze gusts up out of the south. I shield my eyes and search the horizon, but nothing moves there. Out beyond the lava reef, the sea begins to chop and lift itself in nervous strokes. "Ciri," I whisper. I say her name without meaning to do so. 100 meters down the slope, the crowd pauses to watch me and to catch its collective breath. The procession of mourners and celebrants stretches for more than a kilometer to where the white buildings of the city begin. I can make out the gray and balding head of my younger son in the vanguard. He's wearing the blue and gold robes of the hegemony. I know that I should wait for him, walk with him, but he and the other aging council members cannot keep up with my young, ship-trained muscles and steady stride. But decorum dictates that I should walk with him and my granddaughter Lyra and my 9-year-old grandson. To hell with it, and to hell with them. I turn and jog up the steep hillside. Sweat begins to soak my loose cotton shirt before I reach the curving summit of the ridge and catch sight of the tomb. Ciri's tomb. I stop. The wind chills me, although the sunlight is warm enough as it glints off the flawless white stone of the silent mausoleum. The grass is high near the sealed entrance to the crypt. Rows of faded festival pennants on ebony staffs line the narrow gravel path. Hesitating, I circle the tomb and approach the steep cliff edge a few meters beyond. The willow grass is bent and trampled here, where irreverent picnickers have laid their blankets. There are several fire rings formed from the perfectly round, perfectly white stones purloined from the border of the gravel path. I cannot stop a smile. I know the view from here. The great curve of the outer harbor with its natural seawall, the low, white buildings of First Sight, and the colorful hulls and masts of the catamarans bobbing at anchorage. Near the pebble beach, beyond Common Hall, a young woman in a white skirt moves toward the water. For a second, I think that it is Ciri, and my heart pounds. I half prepare to throw up my arms in response to her wave, but she does not wave. I watch in silence as the distant figure turns away and is lost in the shadows of the old boat building. Above me, far out from the cliff, a wide-winged Thomas Hawk circles above the lagoon on rising thermals and scans the shifting blue kelp beds with its infrared vision, seeking out harp seals or torpids. Nature is stupid, I think, and sit on the soft grass. Nature sets the stage all wrong for such a day. And then it is insensitive enough to throw in a bird, searching for prey which have long since fled the polluted waters near the growing city. I remember another Thomas Hawk on that first night when Ciri and I came to this hilltop. I remember the moonlight on its wings, and the strange, haunting cry which echoed off the cliff and seemed to pierce the dark air above the gas lights of the village below. Ciri was 16. No, not quite 16. And the moonlight that touched the hawk's wings above us also painted her bare skin with milky light and cast shadows beneath the soft circles of her breasts. We looked up guiltily when the bird's cry cut the night, and Ciri said, "It was the nightingale and not the lark that pierced the fearful hollow of thine ear." "Huh?" I said. Ciri was almost 16. I was 19. But Ciri knew the slow pace of books and the cadences of theater under the stars. I knew only the stars. "Relax, young shipman," she whispered, and pulled me down beside her then. "It's only an old Tom's hawk hunting. Stupid bird. Come back, shipman. Come back, Marin." The Los Angeles had chosen that moment to rise above the horizon and to float like a wind-borne ember west across the strange constellations of Maui Covenant, Ciri's world. I lay next to her and described the workings of the great Hawking Drive spin ship which was catching the high sunlight against the drop of night above us. And all the while, my hand was sliding lower along her smooth side. Her skin seemed all velvet and electricity, and her breath came more quickly against my shoulder. I lowered my face to the hollow of her neck, to the sweat and perfume essence of her tousled hair. "Ciri," I say, and this time her name is not unbidden. Below me, below the crest of the hill and the shadow of the white tomb, the crowd stands and shuffles. They are impatient with me. They want me to unseal the tomb, to enter, and to have my private moment in the cool, silent emptiness that has replaced the warm presence that was Ciri. They want me to say my farewell so they can get on with their rites and rituals, open the Farcaster doors, and join the waiting world web of the hegemony. To hell with that, and to hell with them. I pull up a tendril of the thickly woven willow grass, chew on the sweet stem, and watch the horizon for the first sign of the migrating islands. The shadows are still long in the morning light. The day is young. I will sit here for a while and remember. I will remember Ciri. Ciri was a... what? A bird, I think, the first time I saw her. She was wearing some sort of mask with bright feathers. When she removed it to join in the race me quadrille, the torchlight caught the deep auburn tints of her hair. She was flushed, cheeks aflame, and even from across the crowded common I could see the startling green of her eyes, contrasting with the summer heat of her face and hair. It was festival night, of course. The torches danced and sparked to the stiff breeze coming in off the harbor, and the sound of the flutists on the breakwall playing for the passing isles was almost drowned out by surf sounds and the crack of pennants snapping in the wind. Ciri was almost 16, and her beauty burned more brightly than any of the torches set round the throng-filled square. I pushed through the dancing crowd and went to her. It was 5 years ago for me. It was more than 65 years ago for us. It seems only yesterday. This is not going well. Where to start?
"What say we go find little Nookie, kid?" Mike Osho was speaking. Short, squat, his pudgy face a clever caricature of a Buddha. Mike was a god to me then. We were all gods. Long-lived, if not immortal. Well-paid, if not quite divine. The hegemony had chosen us to help crew one of its precious quantum leap spin ships, so how could we be less than gods? It was just that Mike, brilliant, mercurial, irreverent Mike, was a little older and a little higher in the shipboard pantheon than young Marin Aspic. "Ha! Zero probability of that," I said. We were scrubbing up after a 12-hour shift with the Farcaster construction crew, shuttling the workers around their chosen singularity point some 163,000 kilometers out from Maui Covenant
was a lot less glamorous for us than the 4-month leap from hegemony space. During the C-plus portion of the trip, we had been master specialists, 49 starship experts shepherding some 200 nervous passengers. Now the passengers had their hard suits on, and we shipmen had been reduced to serving as glorified truck drivers. As the construction crew wrestled the bulky singularity containment sphere into place. Zero probability, I repeated, unless the groundlings have added a whorehouse to that quarantine island they leased us.
Nope, they haven't, grinned Mike.
He and I had our 3 days of planetary R&R coming up, but we knew from Shipmaster Singh's briefings and the moans of our shipmates that the only ground time we had to look forward to would be spent on a 7-by-4-kilometer island administered by the hegemony. It wasn't even one of the Motal Isles we had heard about, just another volcanic peak near the equator. Once there, we could count on real gravity underfoot, unfiltered air to breathe, and the chance to taste unsynthesized food. But we could also count on the fact that the only intercourse we would have with the Maui Covenant colonists would be through buying local artifacts at the duty-free store. Even those were sold by hegemony trade specialists. Many of our shipmates had chosen to spend their R&R on the Los Angeles. So how do we find a little nookie, Mike? The colonies are off-limits until the Farcaster's working. That's about 60 years away, local time. Or are you talking about Meg in Spin Comp?
Stick with me, kid, said Mike. Where there's a will, there's a way.
I stuck with Mike. There were only 5 of us in the dropship. It was always a thrill to me to fall out of high orbit into the atmosphere of a real world, especially a world that looked as much like old Earth as Maui Covenant did. I stared at the blue and white limb of the planet until the seas were down and we were in atmosphere, approaching the Twilight Terminator in a gentle glide at 3 times the speed of our own sound. We were gods then. But even gods must descend from their high thrones upon occasion.
Ciri's body never ceased to amaze me. That time on the archipelago. 3 weeks in that huge, swaying treehouse under the billowing tree sails, with the dolphin herders keeping pace like outriders, tropical sunsets filling the evening with wonder, the canopy of stars at night, and our own wake marked by 1,000 phosphorescent swirls that mirrored the constellations above. And still, it is Ciri's body I remember. For some reason, shyness, the years of separation, she wore 2 strips of swimsuit for the first few days of our archipelago stay, and the soft white of her breasts and lower belly had not darkened to match the rest of her tan before I had to leave again. I remember her that first time. Triangles in the moonlight as we lay in the soft grass above First Sight Harbor, her silk pants catching on a weave of willow grass. There was a child's modesty then, the slight hesitation of something given prematurely, but also pride, the same pride that later allowed her to face down the angry mob of separatists on the steps of the hegemony consulate in South Turn and send them to their homes in shame. I remember my 5th planetfall, our 4th reunion. It was one of the few times I ever saw her cry. She was almost regal in her fame and wisdom by then. She had been elected 4 times to the All-Thing, and the hegemony council turned to her for advice and guidance. She wore her independence like a royal cloak, and her fierce pride had never burned more brightly. But when we were alone, in the stone villa south of Feveron, it was she who turned away. I was nervous, frightened by this powerful stranger, but it was Ciri, Ciri of the straight back and proud eyes, who turned her face to the wall and said through tears, go away, Meryn. I don't want you to see me. I'm a crone, all slack and sagging. Go away. I confess that I was rough with her then. I pinned her wrists with my left hand, using a strength which surprised even me, and tore her silken robe down the front in one move. I kissed her shoulders, her neck, the faded shadows of stretch marks on her taut belly,
and the scar on her upper leg from the skimmer crash some 40 of her years earlier. I kissed her graying hair, and the lines etched in her once smooth cheeks. I kissed her tears.
"Jesus, Mike, this can't be legal," I'd said when my friend unrolled the hawking mat from his backpack. We were on Island 241, as the hegemony traders had so romantically named the desolate volcanic blemish which they had chosen for our R&R site. Island 241 was less than 50 kilometers from the oldest of the colonial settlements, but it might as well have been 50 light-years away. No native ships were to put in at the island while Los Angeles crewmen or Farcaster workmen were present. The Maui Covenant colonists had a few ancient skimmers still in working order, but by mutual agreement there would be no overflights. Except for the dormitories, swimming beach, and the duty-free store, there was little on the island to interest us shipmen. Someday, when the last components had been brought in system by the Los Angeles and the Farcaster finished, hegemony officials would make Island 241 into a center for trade and tourism. Until then, it was a primitive place, with a dropship grid, newly finished buildings of the local white stone, and a few bored maintenance people. Mike checked the two of us out for 3 days of backpacking on the steepest and most inaccessible end of the little island. "I don't want to go backpacking, for Christ's sake," I'd said. "I'd rather stay on the L.A. and plug into a stim sim." "Shut up and follow me," said Mike, and, like a lesser member of the pantheon following an older and wiser deity, I had shut up and followed. 2 hours of heavy tramping up the slopes through sharp-branched scrub trees brought us to a lip of lava several hundred meters above the crashing surf. We were near the equator, on a mostly tropical world, but on this exposed ledge the wind was howling, and my teeth were chattering. The sunset was a red smear between dark cumulus to the west, and I had no wish to be out in the open when full night descended. "Come on," I said, "let's get out of the wind and build a fire. I don't know how the hell we're going to set up a tent on all of this rock." Mike sat down and lit a cannabis stick. "Take a look in your pack, kid." I hesitated. His voice had been neutral, but it was the flat neutrality of the practical joker's voice just before the bucket of water descends. I crouched down and began pawing through the nylon sack. The pack was empty, except for old flow foam packing cubes to fill it out. Those and a harlequin's costume, complete with mask and bells on the toes. Are you goddamn crazy?" I spluttered. It was getting dark quickly now. The storm might or might not pass to the south of us. The surf was rasping below like a hungry beast. If I had known how to find my own way back to the trade compound in the dark, I might have considered leaving Mike Osho's remains to feed the fishes far below. "Now look at what's in my pack," he said. Mike dumped out some flow foam cubes and then removed some jewelry, of the type I'd seen handcrafted on Renaissance Vector. An inertial compass, a laser pen which might or might not be labeled a concealed weapon by ship security, another harlequin costume, this one tailored to his more rotund form, and a hawking mat. "Jesus, Mike," I said while running my hand over the exquisite design of the old carpet, "this can't be legal." "I didn't notice any customs agents back there," grinned Mike. "And I seriously doubt that the locals have any traffic control ordinances." "Yes, but—" I trailed off and unrolled the rest of the mat. It was a little more than a meter wide and about 2 meters long. The rich fabric had faded with age, but the flight threads were still as bright as new copper. "Where did you get it?" I asked. "Does it still work?" "On Garden," said Mike, and stuffed my costume and his other gear into his backpack. "Yes, it does." It had been more than a century since old Vladimir Sholokhov, old Earth emigrant, master lepidopterist, and EM systems engineer, had handcrafted the first hawking mat for his beautiful young niece on New Earth. Legend had it that the niece had scorned the gift, but over the decades the toys had become almost absurdly popular, more with rich adults than with children.
until they were outlawed on most hegemony worlds. Dangerous to handle, a waste of shielded monofilaments, almost impossible to deal with in controlled airspace, hawking mats had become curiosities, reserved for bedtime stories, museums, and a few colony worlds. "It must have cost you a fortune," I said. 30 marks, said Mike, and settled himself on the center of the carpet. The old dealer in Carvnell Marketplace thought it was worthless. It was, for him. I brought it back to the ship, charged it up, reprogrammed the inertia chips, and voila! Mike palmed the intricate design, and the mat stiffened and rose 15 centimeters above the rock ledge. I stared doubtfully. All right, I said. But what if it... It won't, said Mike, and impatiently patted the carpet behind him. It's fully charged. I know how to handle it. Come on, climb on, or stand back. I want to get going before that storm gets any closer. But I don't think... Come on, Marin! Make up your mind. I'm in a hurry. I hesitated for another second or two. If we were caught leaving the island, we would both be kicked off the ship. Shipwork was my life now. I had made that decision when I accepted the 8-mission Maui Covenant contract. More than that, I was 200 light-years and 5.5 leap-years from civilization. Even if they brought us back to hegemony space, the round trip would have cost us 11 years worth of friends and family. The time debt was irrevocable. I crawled on the hovering hawking mat behind Mike. He stuffed the backpack between us, told me to hang on, and tapped at the flight designs. The mat rose 5 meters above the ledge, banked quickly to the left, and shot out over the alien ocean. 300 meters below us, the surf crashed whitely in the deepening gloom. We rose higher above the rough water and headed north into the night. In such seconds of decision, entire futures are made. I remember talking to Siri during our second reunion, shortly after we first visited the villa along the coast near Feveron. We were walking along the beach. Alan had been allowed to stay in the city under Magritte's supervision. It was just as well. I was not truly comfortable with the boy. Only the undeniable green solemnity of his eyes and the disturbing mirror familiarity of his short, dark curls and snub of a nose served to tie him to me, to us, in my mind. That and the quick, almost sardonic smile I would catch him hiding from Siri when she reprimanded him. It was a smile too cynically amused and self-observant to be so practiced in a 10-year-old. I knew it well. I would have thought such things were learned, not inherited. "You know very little," Siri said to me. She was wading, shoeless, in a shallow tide pool. From time to time she would lift the delicate shell of a French horn conch, inspect it for flaws, and drop it back into the silty water. "I've been well trained," I replied. "Yes, I'm sure you've been well trained," agreed Siri. "I know you are quite skillful, Marin, but you know very little." Irritated, unsure of how to respond, I walked along with my head lowered. I dug a white lava stone out of the sand and tossed it far out into the bay. Rain clouds were piling along the eastern horizon. I found myself wishing that I was back aboard the ship. I had been reluctant to return this time, and now I knew that it had been a mistake. It was my third visit to Maui Covenant, our second reunion, as the poets and her people were calling it. I was 5 months away from being 21 standard years old. Siri had just celebrated her 37th birthday 3 weeks earlier. "I've been to a lot of places you've never seen," I said at last. It sounded petulant and childish, even to me. "Oh, yes," said Siri, and clapped her hands together. For a second, in her enthusiasm, I glimpsed my other Siri, the young girl I had dreamed about during the long 9 months of turnaround. Then the image slid back to harsh reality, and I was all too aware of her short hair, the loosening neck muscles, and the cords appearing on the backs of those once beloved hands. "You've been to places I'll never see," said Siri in a rush. Her voice was the same. almost the same. "Marin, my love, you've already seen things I cannot even imagine. You probably know more facts about the universe than I would guess exist. But you know very little, my darling."
"What the hell are you talking about, Siri?"
I sat down on a half-submerged log near the strip of wet sand and drew my knees up like a fence between us. Siri strode out of the tide pool and came to kneel in front of me. She took my hands in hers, and although mine were bigger, heavier, blunter of finger and bone, I could feel the strength in hers. I imagined it as the strength of years I had not shared. "You have to live to really know things, my love. Having Alon has helped me to understand that. There is something about raising a child that helps to sharpen one's sense of what is real."
"How do you mean?"
Siri squinted away from me for a few seconds and absently brushed back a strand of hair. Her left hand stayed firmly around both of mine.
"I'm not sure," she said softly.
"I think one begins to feel when things aren't important. I'm not sure how to put it. When you've spent 30 years entering rooms filled with strangers, you feel less pressure than when you've had only half that number of years of experience. You know what the room and the people in it probably hold for you, and you go looking for it. If it's not there, you sense it earlier and leave to go about your business. You just know more about what is, what isn't, and how little time there is to learn the difference. Do you understand, Marin? Do you follow me even a little bit?"
"No," I said.
Siri nodded and bit her lower lip. But she did not speak again for a while. Instead, she leaned over and kissed me. Her lips were dry and a little questioning. I held back for a second, seeing the sky beyond her, wanting time to think. But then I felt the warm intrusion of her tongue and closed my eyes. The tide was coming in behind us. I felt a sympathetic warmth and rising as Siri unbuttoned my shirt and ran sharp fingernails across my chest. There was a second of emptiness between us, and I opened my eyes in time to see her unfastening the last buttons on the front of her white dress. Her breasts were larger than I remembered, heavier, the nipples broader and darker. The chill air nipped at both of us until I pulled the fabric down her shoulders and brought our upper bodies together. We slid down along the log to the warm sand. I pressed her closer, all the while wondering how I possibly could have thought her the stronger one. Her skin tasted of salt. Siri's hands helped me, her short hair pressed back against the bleached wood, white cotton and sand. My pulse outraced the surf.
"Do you understand, Marin?"
she whispered to me seconds later, as her warmth connected us.
"Yes,"
I whispered back, but I did not. Mike brought the hawking mat in from the east toward first sight. The flight had taken over an hour in the dark, and I had spent most of the time huddling from the wind and waiting for the carpet to fold up and tumble us both into the sea. We were still half an hour out when we saw the first of the Motal Isles. Racing before the storm, tree sails billowing, the islands sailed up from their southern feeding grounds in seemingly endless procession. Many were lit brilliantly, festooned with colored lanterns and shifting veils of gossamer light.
"You sure this is the way?" I shouted.
"Yes,"
shouted Mike. He did not turn his head. The wind whipped his long black hair back against my face. From time to time he would check his compass and make small corrections to our course. It might have been easier to follow the isles. We passed one, a large one, almost half a kilometer in length, and I strained to make out details, but the isle was dark except for the glow of its phosphorescent wake. Dark shapes cut through the milky waves. I tapped Mike on the shoulder and pointed.
"Dolphins!" he shouted. "That's what this colony was all about, remember? A bunch of do-gooders during the Hegira wanted to save all the mammals in old Earth's oceans. Didn't succeed."
I would have shouted another question, but at that moment the headland and First Sight Harbor came into view. I had thought the stars were bright above Maui Covenant, I had thought the migrating islands were memorable in their colorful display. But the city of First Sight, wrapped about with harbor and hills, was a blazing beacon in the night. Its brilliance reminded me of a torch ship I once had watched while it created its own plasma nova against the dark limb of a sullen gas giant. The city was a five-tiered honeycomb of white buildings, all illuminated by warmly glowing lanterns from within and by countless torches from without. The white lava stone of the volcanic island itself seemed to glow from the city light. Beyond the town were tents, pavilions, campfires, cooking fires, and great flaming pyres, too large for function, too large for anything except to serve as a welcome to the returning isles. The harbor was filled with boats, bobbing catamarans with cowbells clanking from their masts, large-hulled, flat-bottomed houseboats built for creeping from port to port in the calm equatorial shallows, but proudly ablaze with strings of light this night, and then the occasional ocean-going yacht, sleek and functional as a shark. A lighthouse set out on the pincer's end of the harbor reef threw its beam far out to sea, illuminated wave and isle alike, and then swept its light back in to catch the colorful bobbing of ships and men. Even from 2 kilometers out we could hear the noise. Sounds of celebration were clearly audible. Above the shouts and constant susurration of the surf rose the unmistakable notes of a Bach flute sonata. I learned later that this welcoming chorus was transmitted through hydrophones to the passage channels, where dolphins leaped and cavorted to the music.
My God, Mike, how did you know all of this was going on?
I asked the main ship computer, said Mike. The Hawking mat banked right to keep us far out from the ships and lighthouse beam. Then we curved back in north of First Sight, toward a dark spit of land. I could hear the soft booming of waves on the shallows ahead. They have this festival every year, Mike went on, but this is their sesquicentennial. The party's been going on for 3 weeks now, and is scheduled to continue another 2. There are only about 100,000 colonists on this whole world, Merrin, and I bet half of them are here, partying. We slowed, came in carefully, and touched down on a rocky outcropping not far from the beach. The storm had missed us to the south, but intermittent flashes of lightning and the distant lights of advancing isles still marked the horizon. Overhead, the stars were not dimmed by the glow from First Sight just over the rise from us. The air was warmer here, and I caught the scent of orchards on the breeze. We folded up the Hawking mat and hurried to get into our Harlequin costumes. Mike slipped his laser pen and jewelry into loose pockets. What are those for? I asked as we secured the backpack and Hawking mat under a large boulder.
These? Asked Mike, as he dangled a Renaissance necklace from his fingers. These are currency, in case we have to negotiate for favors.
Favors?
Favors, repeated Mike. A lady's largesse, comfort to a weary spacefarer. Nookie to you, kid.
Oh, I said, and adjusted my mask and fool's cap. The bells made a soft sound in the dark.
Come on, said Mike. We'll miss the party.
I nodded and followed him, bells jangling, as we picked our way over stone and scrub toward the waiting light. I sit here in the sunlight and wait. I am not totally certain what I am waiting for. I can feel a growing warmth on my back as the morning sunlight is reflected from the white stone of Ceres' tomb. Ceres' tomb. There are no clouds in the sky. I raise my head and squint skyward as if I might be able to see the L.A. and the newly finished Farcaster array through the glare of atmosphere. I cannot. Part of me knows that they have not risen yet. Part of me knows to the second, the time remaining before ship and Farcaster complete their transit to the zenith. Part of me does not want to think about it. Ciri, am I doing the right thing? There is the sudden sound of pennants stirring on their staffs as the wind comes up. I sense, rather than see, the restlessness of the waiting crowd. For the first time since my planetfall for this, our 6th reunion, I am filled with sorrow. No, not sorrow, not yet, but a sharp-toothed sadness which soon will open into grief. For years I have carried on silent conversations with Ciri, framing questions to myself for future discussion with her, and it suddenly strikes me with cold clarity that we will never again sit together and talk. An emptiness begins to grow inside me.
Should I let it happen, Ciri?
There is no response, except for the growing murmurs of the crowd. In a few minutes they will send Danelle, my younger and surviving son, or his daughter Lyra and her brother up the hill to urge me on. I toss away the sprig of willow grass I've been chewing on. There is a hint of shadow on the horizon. It could be a cloud. Or it could be the first of the isles, driven by instinct and the spring northerlies to migrate back to the great band of the equatorial shallows from whence they came. It does not matter.
Ciri, am I doing the right thing?
There is no answer, and the time grows shorter. Sometimes Ciri seemed so ignorant it made me sick. She knew nothing of my life away from her. She would ask questions, but I sometimes wondered if she was interested in the answers. I spent many hours explaining the beautiful physics behind our spin ships, but she never did seem to understand. Once, after I had taken great care to detail the differences between their ancient siege ship and the Los Angeles, Ciri astounded me by asking, "But why did it take my ancestors 80 years of ship time to reach Maui Covenant, when you can make the trip in 130 days? She had understood nothing. Ciri's sense of history was, at best, pitiful. She viewed the hegemony and the world web the way a child would view the fantasy world of a pleasant but rather silly myth. There was an indifference there that almost drove me mad at times. Ciri knew all about the early days of the Hegira, at least insofar as they pertained to the Maui Covenant and the colonists, and she occasionally would come up with delightful bits of archaic trivia or phraseology, but she knew nothing of post-Hegira realities. Names like Garden and the Ousters, Renaissance and Lussus meant little to her. I could mention Salmud Brevi or General Horace Glennon Height, and she would have no associations or reactions at all. None. The last time I saw Ciri, she was 70 standard years old. She was 70 years old, and still she had never traveled off-world, used a fat line, tasted any alcoholic drink except wine, interfaced with an empathy surgeon, stepped through a Farcaster door, smoked a cannabis stick, received gene tailoring, plugged into a stim sim, received any formal schooling, taken any RNA medication, heard of Zen Gnostics or the Shrike Church, or flown any vehicle except an ancient Vicken skimmer belonging to her family. Ciri had never made love to anyone except me, or so she said, and so I believed. It was during our first reunion, that time on the archipelago, when Ciri took me to talk with the dolphins. We had risen to watch the dawn. The highest levels of the treehouse were a perfect place from which to watch the eastern sky pale and fade to morning. Ripples of high cirrus turned to rose, and then the sea itself grew molten as the sun floated above the flat horizon.
"Let's go swimming," said Ciri.
The rich horizontal light bathed her skin and threw her shadow 4 meters across the boards of the platform. "I'm too tired," I said. "Later." We had lain awake most of the night, talking, making love, talking and making love again. In the glare of morning, I felt empty and vaguely nauseated. I sensed the slight movement of the isle under me as a tinge of vertigo, a drunkard's disconnection from gravity.
"No, let's go now," said Ciri, and grasped my hand to pull me along.
I was irritated, but did not argue. Ciri was 26, 7 years older than I during that first reunion, but her impulsive behavior often reminded me of the teenaged Ciri I had carried away from the festival only 10 of my months earlier. Her deep, unself-conscious laugh was the same. Her green eyes cut as sharply when she was impatient. The long mane of auburn hair had not changed. But her body had ripened, filled out with a promise which had been only hinted at before. Her breasts were still high and full, almost girlish, bordered above by freckles that gave way to a whiteness so translucent that a gentle blue tracery of veins could be seen. But they were different, somehow. She was different. "Are you going to join me, or just sit there staring?" asked Ciri. She had slipped off her caftan as we came out onto the lowest deck. Our small ship was still tied to the dock. Above us, the island's tree sails were beginning to open to the morning breeze. For the past several days, Ciri had insisted on wearing swim strips when we went into the water. She wore none now. Her nipples rose in the cool air. "Won't we be left behind?" I asked, squinting up at the flapping tree sails. On previous days we had waited for the doldrums in the middle of the day, when the isle was still in the water, the sea a glazed mirror. Now the jib-vines were beginning to pull taut as the thick leaves filled with wind. "Don't be silly," said Ciri. "We could always catch a keel root and follow it back, that or a feeding tendril. Come on." She tossed an osmosis mask at me and donned her own. The transparent film made her face look slick with oil. From the pocket of her caftan she lifted a thick medallion and set it in place around her neck. The metal looked dark and ominous against her skin. "What's that?" I asked. Ciri did not lift the osmosis mask to answer. She set the comm threads in place against her neck and handed me the hearplugs. Her voice was tinny. "Translation disc," she said. "Thought you knew all about gadgets, Marin. Last one in's a sea slug." She held the disc in place between her breasts with one hand and stepped off the aisle. I could see the pale globes of her buttocks as she pirouetted and kicked for depth. In seconds, she was only a white blur deep in the water. I slipped my own mask on, pressed the comm threads tight, and stepped into the sea. The bottom of the aisle was a dark stain on a ceiling of crystalline light. I was wary of the thick feeding tendrils, even though Ciri had amply demonstrated that they were interested in devouring nothing larger than the tiny zooplankton that even now caught the sunlight like dust in an abandoned ballroom. Keel roots descended like gnarled stalactites for hundreds of meters into the purple depths. The aisle was moving. I could see the faint fibrillation of the tendrils as they trailed along. A wake caught the light 10 meters above me. For a second I was choking, the gel of the mask smothering me as surely as the surrounding water would. And then I relaxed, and the air flowed freely into my lungs. "Deeper, Marin," came Ciri's voice. I blinked, a slow-motion blink as the mask readjusted itself over my eyes, and caught sight of Ciri 20 meters lower, grasping a keel root and trailing effortlessly above the colder, deeper currents where the light did not reach. I thought of the thousands of meters of water under me, of the things which might lurk there, unknown, unsought out by the human colonists. I thought of the dark and the depths, and my scrotum tightened involuntarily. "Come on down!" Ciri's voice was an insect buzz in my ears. I rotated and kicked. The buoyancy here was not so great as in old Earth's seas, but it still took energy to dive so deep. The mask compensated for depth and nitrogen, but I could feel the pressure against my skin and ears. Finally I quit kicking, grabbed a keel root, and roughly hauled myself down to Ciri's level. We floated side by side in the dim light. Ciri was a spectral figure here, her long hair swirling in a wine-dark nimbus, the pale strips of her body glowing in the blue-green light. The surface seemed impossibly distant. The widening V of the wake and the drift of the scores of tendrils showed that the isle was moving more quickly now, moving mindlessly to other feeding grounds, distant waters. "Where are the—" I began to sub-vocalize. "Shh," said Ciri.
She fiddled with the medallion. I could hear them then. The shrieks and trills, and whistles, and cat purrs, and echoing cries. The depths were suddenly filled with strange music. Jesus, I said. And because Siri had tuned our comm threads to the translator, the word was broadcast as a senseless whistle and toot. Hello, she called, and the translated greeting echoed from the transmitter, a high-speed bird's call sliding into the ultrasonic. Hello, she called again. Minutes passed before the dolphins came to investigate. They rolled past us, surprisingly large, alarmingly large, their skin looking slick and muscled in the uncertain light. A large one swam within a meter of us, turning at the last moment so that the white of his belly curved past us like a wall. I could see the dark eye rotate to follow me as he passed. One stroke of his wide fluke kicked up a turbulence strong enough to convince me of the animal's power. Hello, called Siri, but the swift form faded into distant haze, and there was a sudden silence. Siri clicked off the translator. Do you want to talk to them? She asked. Sure. I was dubious. More than 3 centuries of effort had not raised much of a dialogue between man and sea mammal. Mike had once told me that the thought structures of old Earth's 2 groups of orphans were too different, the reference too few. One pre-Hegira expert had written that speaking to a dolphin or porpoise was about as rewarding as speaking to a 1-year-old human infant. Both sides usually enjoyed the exchange, and there was a simulacrum of conversation, but neither party would come away the more knowledgeable. Siri switched the translator disc back on. Hello? I said. There was a final minute of silence, and then our earphones were buzzing while the sea echoed shrill ululations.
Distance. No fluke. Hello, tone. Current pulse. Circle me? Funny?
What the hell? I asked Siri, and the translator trilled out my question. Siri was grinning under her osmosis mask. I tried again. Hello. Greetings from, the surface. How are you? The large male, I assumed it to be a male, curved in toward us like a torpedo. He arch-kicked his way through the water 10 times faster than I could have swum, even if I had remembered to don flippers that morning. For a second I thought he was going to ram us, and I raised my knees and clung tightly to the keel root. Then he was past us, climbing for air, while Siri and I reeled from his turbulent wake and the high tones of his shout.
No fluke! No feed! No swim! No play! No fun!
Siri switched off the translator and floated closer. She lightly grasped my shoulders while I held on to the keel root with my right hand. Our legs touched as we drifted through the warm water. A school of tiny crimson warrior fish flickered above us while the dark shapes of the dolphins circled farther out.
Had enough?
She asked. Her hand was flat on my chest.
One more try, I said.
Siri nodded and twisted the disc to life. The current pushed us together again. She slid her arm around me.
Why do you herd the islands?
I asked the bottlenosed shapes circling in the dappled light.
How does it benefit you to stay with the isles?
Sounding now. Old songs. Deep water. No great voices. No shark. Old songs. New songs.
Siri's body lay along the length of me now. Her left arm tightened around me.
Great voices were the whales, she whispered.
Her hair fanned out in streamers. Her right hand moved down and seemed surprised at what it found.
Do you miss the great voices?
I asked the shadows. There was no response. Siri slid her legs around my hips. The surface was a churning bowl of light 40 meters above us.
What do you miss most of old Earth's oceans? I asked.
With my left arm, I pulled Siri closer, slid my hand down along the curve of her back to where her buttocks rose to meet my palm. held her tight.
To the circling dolphins we must have appeared a single creature. Ciri lifted herself against me, and we became a single creature. The translator disc had twisted around, so it trailed over Ciri's shoulder. I reached to shut it off, but paused as the answer to my question buzzed urgently in our ears.
"Miss Shark! Miss Shark! Miss Shark! Miss Shark! 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 Shark!"
I turned off the disc and shook my head. I did not understand. There was so much I did not understand. I closed my eyes as Ciri and I moved gently to the rhythms of the current and ourselves, while the dolphins swam nearby and the cadence of their calls took on the sad, slow trilling of an old lament.